And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. When I made my very first visit to Switzerland in around late 1983, early 84, I can't recall the exact date, I still clearly remember two things. My confusion at the word Zug, or Zug, as I first mispronounced it, and seeing lots of young men in military uniform and carrying backpacks and machine guns gathered at the railway platforms in Zurich Main Station and in Zug. Zug was my final destination. That's where my British employer had moved the company for which I worked and where I was about to relocate and live with my wife and three young children. It was all a long time ago. Now, those of you familiar with the German language will know that the word Zug also means train or locomotive. And now you understand my confusion looking at the train timetable at Zurich's Kloten Airport and trying to find the Zug to Zug. That short word was all over the signboard. But all these young men in military uniform kissing their girlfriends goodbye and chatting to their friends as they walked, waited for their trains, what was all that about? Was this not a neutral country that had not been to war for longer than anyone could remember? And what kind of mobilization was this that I seemed to be in the middle of, at least on the platform of the railway station? Well, all that was 39 years ago. I know a lot more now, but not being a Swiss citizen and not having sons who are Swiss citizens either, I've never had really close family contact with the Swiss Army, except through good male Swiss friends, and so would not pretend to have close knowledge either. So you'll appreciate that a certain curiosity has brought me to where I am today and to be with my very special guest. I'm in Payern, in the beautiful countryside of the Swiss French-speaking canton of Vaud, the canton in which I've lived for a long time, though at the opposite end, the southwestern end. And I'm the guest of the chief of the Swiss Armed Forces, Lieutenant General Thomas Süssli. Hello, General Süssli. It's good to see you again. Thanks for inviting me and all our listeners to the McKay interview to this most fascinating place.
Hello, Michael. Thank you for having me.
It's really good to be here. Passed it many times on the train, but never stopped before. Now, we've met before on the occasion of your visit to the British Swiss Chamber of Commerce in Geneva last year when you gave a brilliant speech, and people still talk about it. And I had many questions for you then, and it won't surprise you to know that I have many questions for you today. But first of all, please tell me what this place is, though I'm sure many of our Swiss listeners will know already. Where are we?
These are barracks where we train our recruits. As you might know, in Switzerland, we have these conscript systems. That means every male at the age of 19 has to go to recruit school. And here in Payern, we train the recruits for ground troops at the Air Force.
And they start at what age?
They start at the age of 19 normally. But they have time until the age of 25 to do their mandatory military service.
So there's a space.
There's a space.
Okay. The General says, you know better than me that there is a war raging less than 2,000 kilometres from Switzerland's eastern border. Many, except confirmed pacifists, see the common sense in armed neutrality. But please explain to me, what does neutral mean to you as the leader of the Swiss Armed Forces? And do you see your country having to make intellectual contortions to uphold its long-held tradition when international law is flouted repeatedly? It can't be easy. Or do you simply take your guidance and your orders from your political bosses and not pass comment except in private?
Actually, there is no difference for me being in private or being in uniform. It's always the same as Chief of Defense. With regards to neutrality, we have to differentiate between neutrality law and neutrality politics. Neutrality law is actually very strict. There are a few rules. One rule is we're not going to support one party in a conflict, and we're not going to deliver weapons. And we're not going to, in a binding contract, for instance, like NATO, into a defense contract. Neutrality politics is a bit more like complicated because there are no strict rules. But in Switzerland, armed forces are strictly below politics, so we also follow like neutrality politics. The border, as mentioned before, is sometimes not very clear. However, within our department, where armed forces are located, we have a department which is responsible for security policy, and normally we would actually discuss and find rules and find wordings for Swiss armed forces to be very clear and be on the right side of neutrality always.
I see. So it is a very sensitive area where you need lots of professional guidance, I suppose, based upon what's happening in the current situation and what happened in the past.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I can imagine. What have you learned, General Sotsky, since the conflict in Ukraine started last year about the way land warfare has changed? I mean, how is Switzerland adjusting its approach to defence because of these learnings? And I'm thinking in particular of drone warfare and the use of tanks.
There are many changes we see, actually. One is in the kind of leadership. We see that mission command is very much superior to like a normal command system, like the Russian army still have it. But then with regards to like what you called old-style war and old-style weapons, actually we see a combination of it, and this is very important, and probably also like a new area in warfare that is beginning now, and you mentioned drones. And what makes this war very new, and which is very new, is the combination of drones being used as sensors, but also being used as weapons in combination with old-style weapons like artillery and tanks. Most of the tanks, Russian tanks, haven't been destroyed by this shoulder-based, like the Enlow system or Javelin, but by precision artillery. And it's the drones actually recognizing the targets and defining the targets for the artillery, and then very precise artillery actually will destroy the tank. And this is something which we think is new. But then also the role of technology as such. The Ukrainians have a system, they call it Delta. It's a newly developed software which helps to, for each commander to actually demand fire and then get the nearest artillery, the nearest cannon to actually provide that fire. This is also something very new.
So could you explain, when you say mission control, that means that the various groups of military men, soldiers, have a certain independence under their local commanding officers. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, there's
just so I understand
that. Absolutely. There's a difference between command system, and like this, the old-based style, but then mission command would actually mean that in the command line, there will be targets being set, objectives being set, and then the forces will then decide within that framework, within that mission, within that objective, can decide their own way how to achieve that goal. This leaves much more freedom, and this makes a huge difference.
And it's quite different from the way the Russian military is operating.
Absolutely,
isn't it?
Which is still, like in the Soviet days, the old-style kind of command system.
I see. Now, I just wanted to turn to the perennial question of money. Defence budgets, as you know, have been cut across many Western countries over the past 10 to 15 years, except until very recently, where increases have been triggered by an aggressive Russia and a much more assertive China. Just explain to me, particularly as a non-military person, and the majority of the people listening to this programme will be non-military people, what's happening in this country? What is the defence budget? And please explain in general terms how the budget is deployed. Army, Air Force, cyber, chemical, or maybe the separations aren't made that way, I don't know. And I hear that you're asking for more money, but how much more, and will that be enough? Or is it ever enough? Sorry for all the questions.
I should say there is never enough. Just joking. But as you mentioned, like in the 90s, when we thought that actually, Francis Fukuyama wrote the book then, The End of History The Last Man. And the idea at that time was that our open, liberal, democratic system will actually span the whole planet. And this has turned out now that this was not right. And the world is going to change. You mentioned China as a new competitor of the US and Russia now being aggressive against a neighbor country. So during the 90s, we paid like the dividend for peace, the peace dividend, and budgets went down to 0.7% of the GDP, which is comparably very low to our neighbor countries. Last year, like also population in Switzerland and also politicians recognized that peace does not only have a value, but also comes at a price. And Parliament decided to increase the budget, the defense budget, to 1% of GDP by 2030. However, due to COVID, there will be budget cuts, and we expect now that increase only being available in 2035, so which is a bit of
a delay. It's quite a long time ahead,
isn't it? It's a long time, and this will delay some procurements, which would actually have helped us increase our defense capabilities or capacities. So, and then your question with regard, how do we spend the money or how do we allocate the money? We have a very holistic approach on armed forces. So we do not differentiate between like armed forces, ground forces, or cyber. We have a holistic approach, which also some countries, some armies, armed forces, is called multi-domain. And we try to develop all the capacities, all the capabilities at the same time and to the desired state and state.
I see. Okay, that's a good clarification, because I really wasn't sure about that. Now, I just want to switch geography a little bit, but something which, again, is very relevant, and many people listening in may not even be aware of this. I want to talk about Kosovo. Many Swiss listening will have a fair idea of Switzerland's commitment there. I think it's been a commitment since 1999.
That's good.
More or less. I'm not
sure
of the exact.
Yeah, that's right.
It's still a long time. But for my benefit, and those listening, and particularly people listening from abroad, tell me, why are the Swiss still there, and how big Switzerland's military presence is in that country, and whether or not the soldiers are armed? And it's my understanding, I heard from a friend of mine, that they might stay there till 2026. But who decides? How are those decisions made? But first of all, why are the Swiss there?
I mean, to understand that Kosovo has a population of about 2 million people.
Yes.
And Switzerland has a diaspora of Kosovarians of 200,000.
As big as that?
Yeah.
Really?
Approximately 10% of Kosovarians live in Switzerland. And if you think back to the 90s, to the war in Yugoslavia, I mean, we had many refugees. And decision here, our decision is, it's better to be on-site, be there, and prevent a crisis rather than to have the problem imported into Switzerland. That's one of the reasons why it's still important, and we consider it being important also going forward. Switzerland has a contingent of 195 soldiers, female and male. Interestingly, we have about 15 to 20% females in Kosovo.
That's quite a big percentage.
Seems to be very attractive also to women to go to Kosovo and to service there. We shift every 6 months, we change the contingent, so we recruit twice a year, 100 or 200 soldiers or volunteers.
They volunteer to go, or you send them?
That's very important. By law, we're not allowed to send them there, so we have to recruit volunteers.
I see.
They will go then for a period of 6 months. And yes, absolutely, they are armed. There's another particularity. I mean, KFOR is Kosovo force of NATO, and for Switzerland to participate in such a contingent in a mission, it needs a UN decision, so it needs a UN mandate.
I see, the UN and comes from New York.
Absolutely, and that's not very well known, but there is a UN mandate for the NATO KFOR mission.
I see, I hadn't realized that. And it's likely to continue until around about 2026?
Every 3 years, Parliament has to renew the decision to send our contingent to Kosovo. This has happened this year, so we're very in a positive situation that we're going to send them from 24 to 27 for that period.
I see. That's a good clarification. Now, as you know, General Suze, I have no military experience, so please don't laugh at me when you hear me question. It sounds very naive, but as weapons become more and more sophisticated, and as longer-range defense and attack systems are a crucial part of combat, where do the Swiss Armed Forces practice using such weapons in what is essentially, geographically, a small country with relatively limited flat or undulating land space? I'm just curious to know. How do you do it?
I mean, Switzerland, as you mentioned, the geographic is very, very particular in Switzerland. However, we still have like the urban region, and we consider urban warfare like the dominant way of fighting wars in the future. So what we do is we prepare our troops, we prepare infantry and also our tank troops for urban warfare. And also, if you want to move on the ground, if you want to move your ground forces, you have to have air protection, and that's why we need an air force, and that's why we decided for the F-35 going to protect our population, but also our ground forces going forward. So we need the whole mix, the whole combination of capabilities, even though we're a small country, but still we have like major routes going through Switzerland from east to west, from north to south, and they have to be protected.
I see. So the actual physical dimensions are not such a critical constraint.
No, not
see.
Really.
I see.
Not even for the Air Force.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have like what is being called in the army lingo is called strategic depth or operational depth. We don't have that. So we don't have like an area of a few hundred kilometers around our main population centers. But still, we need an air force protecting this. And the F-35 has very strong like sensor capabilities in the electromagnetic room, but also with radar. And this will help us to see into the depths of across our borders.
I see. That helps a lot. My guest today is the chief of the Swiss Armed Forces, Lieutenant General Thomas Süssli, and I'm with him in Payen to talk about the very special role in Switzerland of the Swiss Army. Now, General Süssli, I'm not sure if you're at liberty to talk about intelligence, but I'm curious to know, and I think you can understand why. How do the Swiss, as a neutral country, glean information and test the validity of that information from an intelligence point of view? What can you say publicly?
Intelligence is not... no country does intelligence on its own. It's a network, and we're part of a network, and we have what we call preferred countries, preferred partners, and with those we exchange a lot of information. So that's just what is... everyone does that, actually. And like it's like a give and take in intelligence.
And being neutral doesn't affect that relationship at all?
Doesn't affect that relationship. Mm-hmm. And actually it doesn't affect neutrality at all. And then we also have our own sensors. So we also obtain own information in probably like in many spaces as everyone else does. So like in electromagnetic space or listening to radio. But also a very important role comes more and more to open source intelligence, so analyzing what is available publicly on the internet or in other sources.
So I didn't quite understand that. So open source, isn't that by definition available to everyone anyway? So what value would that be? Or is it just that with a particular insight, you can define and discern from that information what other people, the ordinary person, wouldn't be able to understand? I didn't quite understand.
The challenge here is to bring all the information together and get the right conclusions out of it. So you analyze like public available, for instance, space or space taken pictures, high resolution pictures that can be bought in the market. It's also open source. And then also intelligence gathered on social media, information on social media. I think what makes a difference between probably a normal person seeing all this information and intelligence is it's the analyst, and it's that background knowledge of the analyst which actually helps them to make the right conclusions based on that information.
I see. I just want to talk about people now. I'm very curious to know what is the attitude of Swiss young men and women towards military service. And I'm sure you must do research just to find out what they're thinking. Remind me, first of all, you said it at the beginning of the program, but just tell me again and our listeners what the obligations on male Swiss citizens are regarding military, and does that apply also to women? And give me some insights into how young Swiss men today, 2023, see the Swiss Army, Swiss military.
Let me just start with your last question. I think, I mean, first of all, is to know we have 34,000 young men every year. And for young men, military service is mandatory, not for women. It's like they're volunteers to women. The goal would be to have 10% women in Swiss Armed Forces by 2030. Right now, we're at 1.4%. So that sounds like bad news. Good news, however, is we doubled that figure during the last 5 years. So it's growing. So that's the good news. So for men, we have 34,000 men every year. And unfortunately, only 53% actually do their military service. They, for medical reasons, many of them, almost 7,000 every year, decide to do civilian service, which is the alternative to do military service. That causes an issue to us because every year, 2,000 too many Swiss may leave military service, and that leaves a gap in the battalions, in the companies, which is very hard, very difficult to cover.
And a young man can get, if you like, permission, if that's the right word, from his own doctor to be exempt, or would he have to come to a military doctor, or is it an opinion of two people, two medical people? How does that work? Because it's an important decision.
recruitment takes place, and there are 2 days, and they're invited, or actually they're called for 2 days, to the examination. There is a sport examination, there is a psychological examination, but then also there is the doctor, the physician, who does the examination, and it's one of armed forces, and actually he will be compared to all the others, his peers, and then evaluated based on his physical condition. And that will decide what troop he's going to join. So when they come to recruitment, they can have their own wishes. Normally, they want to go to infantry. But at the end, it's the doctor and it's the physical status, the sports test, which decides and if he's allowed to go there.
I see. Because, I mean, each one of them depends on the other for the strength of the team. Huh?
And we try to allocate everyone based on his individual strengths to a certain type of troops and then to a certain recruit school he's then called into.
And can I just press you a little bit more on the female side? I mean, you said the numbers are small, but I can imagine over for how many decades this army has been a male institution, it's going to take time for women anyway to come around to thinking that way. But in your own mind, what do you see as a potential career for women in the Swiss Army? Where are there particular areas that they would be good at? Or is that not something which you've actually looked at from one sex to another point of view? I'm just curious to know how they would all mesh as a team, because that's critical for you, I'd imagine, as commanding officer.
Looking at the economy, I think what makes success in the economy are diverse teams, so teams mixed of male, female, and also different personalities and strengths. And the same applies also to armed forces. So it would be a big mistake to not include women and not benefit actually from the knowledge and probably also the different kind of thinking women brings into armed forces. All positions are open to women. All positions are open to women. So we have a fighter pilot, we have tank battalion commanders who are female, and all positions are open. But still, as our physical limitations, that's sometimes a bit of an issue. I mean, many women would like to go to special forces, but then physical tests will not allow them to do that.
I can understand that. That's the same with the British Army as well.
Most probably, because the physical requirements are all the same, and they have to actually wear heavy duty. And also some of the weapon systems are rather heavy to transport and take. So theoretically, all functions are open. Looking forward, actually, to have the first women in Special Forces recruit school. We had one last year, but unfortunately, for other reasons, she had to leave. But looking forward for the next one, that will be then the first in Special Forces.
Sorry, no, I didn't mean to interrupt. You were going to say something else.
What I meant to say, and then also typically in the old days, women were mainly in medics, doing medical service, or training dogs, so-called canines, like search dogs or rescue dogs. But I'm glad actually this is over now, and I see more and more women also in the infantry and tanks troops.
But just to be clear, the physical standard, the physical capability, the bar is set high, and if a woman meets that standard, that's okay.
Everything is open to that.
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to understand that. Now, another question which fascinates me, and again, you'll probably smile, and I'm sure you'll tell me, Michael, the answer is obvious, is languages. I mean, I lived 9 years in Zug, and I can just about make myself understood in Swedish. You might smile to hear that. But what I'm interested in is, how does the Swiss Armed Forces deal with 3 official languages, 4 national languages across the command structure? How does it work?
I mean, in general, we try to treat all the languages equal, or actually don't give disadvantages based on language. This, I would say, works very well for German and French. Sometimes a bit more difficult for Italian-speaking part of Switzerland. They make 5%. And because we don't have many career officers and trainers who speak Italian, it's also then difficult to train them and to attract Italians to all the functions. But here the same, all functions theoretically are open to everyone. The fourth language, which is called Ramunj.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, all Ramunj speaking, they also speak one of the other languages. Yes, yes. So we don't have to translate everything into a fourth language. And then what is interesting, I mean, in general, everyone is allowed to speak his own language and the others are supposed to understand.
Just like the parliament.
It's a bit like in the parliament.
Yeah? My gosh.
Everyone speaks his own language. But then also, like, as a superior, you try to speak the language of your subordinates. That's kind of normal. And also interesting, I mean, the troops are also, after recruit school, they would be incorporated into battalions, into combat battalions or infantry battalions. And also, we try to also mix them more and more, which is not that easy. And in some areas, for instance, cyber, there the official language actually would be still German or French, but they speak English.
Yes.
Because that's the language.
The IT language.
Yeah, IT slang and IT lingo, exactly.
Yeah. No, I was curious to know how that works. Just another question on that then. So is the command structure organized around cantons as well, or are these lines blurred, say as we're in the French, between Geneva and Fribourg and Valais, and it's these young men come and go, do they, or is it essentially around the cantons? I never understood that properly.
That's a typical Swiss issue, actually.
Okay.
If you ask a Swiss about anything, he normally would answer, depends on the canton.
It's hängt von. Yeah,
depends on the canton.
C'est dépend.
Ça dépend. En canton. It's actually a bit the same here. I mean, every battalion, I mean, there are no canton battalions anymore. We stopped doing that in the 90s. So all troops, battalions are on a federal level. However, every battalion is allocated to a canton, we say, for special purpose. And also a canton, like the government of the canton, would go and visit that battalion and have a more personal relationship, which helps us to be better rooted into politics, but also better rooted into cantons.
That's a good idea. I didn't know that. I see. Yeah.
I would say it's a good idea.
Okay, yeah. Last question, General Sisley. This question continues from my prior question about languages. But please explain, and this is part philosophy and part your practical experience as a senior officer now at the top of the pyramid, the bigger role of the Swiss Armed Forces, the bigger role the army plays in the culture and the cohesion, I know it's very important in Switzerland, right across the Confederation, because of the variety. And I know this is important to the Swiss, the socialization of its young men and eventually its young women. How do you see the army fitting into the bigger jigsaw puzzle of Swiss life in 2023?
First of all, our armed forces, like having a conscript system, are like male, female Swiss who do a special service for the purpose of security for everyone. And that's the understanding we have of our armed forces. There's a second role, actually. As like Swiss, if you grew up in Zurich, you probably would do your military service in Tessin or in the French-speaking part. And this also gives more cohesion to Switzerland.
Because your first service or all of your services?
It can be that you do your first service, but all your service in a completely different part of Switzerland.
Right.
So you learn more about Switzerland.
Of course.
And actually, many actually would go back for holidays to the places where they did their military service.
Really?
Yeah. And it's also kind of a glue between like social levels in Switzerland, because you see all kind of professions in military service. You do service in a battalion or in a platoon with people like from other regions, other professions, other social levels, and that helps like glue Switzerland together.
No, I understand. I see that, and I obviously just having lived here for so long, and many friends of mine, you know, well past the retirement age for the army, but tell me about their experiences. And I've even been invited to some of the anciens combattants, I'm sure that's not the correct phrase in Swiss French, but in Geneva. And I can just by looking around the room see the long relationships they've had with their friends, and it's good. Yeah. It's very encouraging. General Sisley, look, thanks again for answering all my questions so fully. I found a question I could go on for much longer. Conversation is absolutely absorbing, fascinating. Time is up. My guest today has been the Chief of the Swiss Armed Forces, Lieutenant General Thomas Sisley. Thank you, General.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.